right. Good morning, everybody. Today is Friday, August 12th, 2016. And this is Before the First Cup of Jewels here on UCY.TV. Happy Friday, everyone. It is a muggy 71 degrees and partly cloudy here in upstate New York. We had quite a bit of rain here yesterday. Again, much, much needed. But now we are dying with the heat and humidity. So where do we leave off yesterday? We titled the show Coding Biological Computers, Biohybrid Machines, AI, Algorithms, and M's. And yeah, we talked about all those things. We talked about them having cells that they can actually program as if it were a computer. They also had these little cyborg stingrays that they had made out of rat heart cells and some sort of silicon that they could send into dangerous situations, apparently, in the future. We also looked at some pre-crime software that they want to use on children, I guess they're talking about, to be able to determine whether or not Johnny is going to be a criminal, statistically speaking, when he gets older, based upon facts from his birth and his situation that he was born into, maybe even some interaction in school. But they'll be able to put some AI against the database for Johnny and figure out whether or not Johnny's going to be a troublemaker when he grows up. And then last but not least, we had a piece of software that would utilize algorithms while watching the police to determine whether or not the police would perform any type of misconduct. So, you know, this whole week has been about augmentation being merged with the machine. We had a chip that they were talking about for full body monitoring, whether or not you would get a biotech implant. They really are kind of pushing that in the mainstream, along with all these new mad science gone mad cures that they are testing for the first time on humans, never before seen. But, you know, don't worry about informed consent, because the desperate and the ill will be the first ones to step right up so we get our free guinea pigs. You know, one of the other things that we've seen is that with this push of getting a chip or getting augmented in some way, you know, they're trying to spin it to the people and show them how wonderful it's going to be, because it's going to make your life so much easier. Like, you won't need passwords anymore. And, you know, passwords are just so passe. There was a story that came out of Scientific American, which is a very long time distinguished publication. I mean, I was reading them in the 80s at the time. This is where I first read about nanotech. Back in those days, they used to get it in hard copy. But, I mean, once you see stories come out in here, you know that this has become part of the agenda. We've been seeing this for a while. Passwords are on the way out, and it is about time. Yeah, it's about time. Because, you know, passwords are so hard to remember. We got hackers under every bed now, and we have this new whole cybersecurity push by DARPA. They've had their AI DEFCON hackers competing against each other in competition, see whether or not they can make a shape-shifting immune system for the internet. The internet that was never built to be secure, and it really wasn't, but they are now taking advantage of vulnerabilities on a daily basis to be able to compromise machines, and they're getting ready to let Skynet loose. But the next thing they got to do is allow us to give up control of our machines that we have on our desktop. And one way that would be passwords. Our tech lives are filled full of pain points. Yes, yeah, that's the corporate spin in the very first few words of the sentence. But at least the world's tech geniuses seem committed to solving them. Today, who complains about the things that bugged them a decade ago, such as heavy laptops and slow internet connections, and the inability to do email on planes? Well, it was only a matter of time before those geniuses started tackling one of the longest running pain points in history, and that is the password. Now, you know, I mentioned yesterday biometrics and the first big rollout that they have had with the Universal ID program. And I found the story from Brandon. It was from 2012 out of India. And they did. I had postulated it was 1.2 billion people. And it absolutely was 1.2 1.2 billion people. India moving ahead with universal biometric ID program despite growing concern. This was May 6, 2012. Go Brandon. Only 3 months ago, I wrote an article titled Cashless Society, India Implements the First Biometric ID Program for All of Its 1.2 Billion Residents. And how insane is that? It consists of fingerprints, iris scans, facial photographs, and the information will be attached to a universal, unique identifier number to be referenced when combined with the traditional methods of identification, including a chip-enhanced national ID card. Now, what is the next step except for the implant with your information bio-encoded on there? But before we get there, we're going to have to make it a little bit easier and get people used to not typing in passwords, to be able to use their superpowers, to be able to wave their hand and authenticate with different things, or just walk into a room and authenticate. Anyway, back to the story. We're supposed to create long, complex, unguessable passwords, capital and lowercase numbers, letters, symbols, maybe a few Arabic letters thrown in if possible, and for each site. And don't reuse your password and change them every single month. Sorry, security experts, that is not possible. Not for the average person, right, with the 8-second attention span. Not even for you. Nobody has that kind of memory anymore. And to make matters worse, passwords aren't even especially secure. See any recent headline about stolen passwords or about some company servers being hacked and it's time to kill the password. Yeah, they're pushing this one hard. Fingerprint readers on smartphones, tablets, and laptops are becoming common, cheap, and convenient, and essentially impossible to hack on large scale. Right. Unless they start chopping off fingers. And so far, they're primarily useful for logging us into our machines. Shouldn't the next step be letting us log into our web accounts? Iris scanning is another biometric technology fast enough to work well at automated border crossing systems and secure enough for national ID programs such as India's, ding ding, as it is enrolling 1.2 billion people. So there you go. And this is a story from this month, August 2016. Brandon was on this in 2012. At the moment, the iris scanners are far too new and expensive to build into every phone and laptop, but almost every technology gets cheaper over time. Some scanners can be fooled by a photograph of your eye, but this problem too can be overcome by tracking your pupils as you read something, for example. Bottom line, there is no insurmountable problem in iris reading's future. The very same with voice authentication, using the unique pitch, accent, and frequencies of your speaking voice as your key. It is cheap enough for wide adoption. Our phones and gadgets already have microphones. Worried about the bad guys faking out the system with a recording of your voice? Well, that can't happen if the phrase you're asked to speak changes every time you log in. The only roadblocks here are background noise and laryngitis. And as with any biometric security solution, this approach really requires a backup system like a password just in case. Then there's new Windows Hello and new features of Windows 10 that lets you log in with fingerprint, iris, or facial recognition, whatever your laptop is equipped to handle, and the face option is especially exciting. Oh, yes, I'm sure it is. Not to people like you and me, who know better. 230-point facial recognition and being able to determine just from looking at your face whether or not you could potentially be a criminal based upon your ethnics is very disturbing to me. You just sit down at the computer and it unlocks instantly. Oh, easy, easy peasy for people who can't remember passwords. You can't fool it with a photograph or even a 3D model of your head because the Intel RealSense camera includes infrared and 3D sensors. Of course, very few gadgets come with that camera pre-installed, but the RealSense concept is the true holy grail. It is secure and convenient. And if the hardware ever becomes ubiquitous and cheap, says our phone's fingerprint readers, could have a winner. Clearly, the password concept is broken. Equally clear, these new technologies can provide both security and the convenience the world demands. Step right up and get in our biometric database. Nothing is quite there yet, but we need to keep an eye on privacy concerns for those who own the database of biometric scans, for example. Could be the one that own everything. Think about that. Just think about that. So once you put your biometric scans out there, anybody who has access to those scans will have access to your accounts. There was a story that came out of CBC News out of Canada, July 22nd. Banks turned face and heartbeat recognition to boost security. Financial sector and others hope biometrics can counter fraud and increase convenience. Of course, it's all about being easy. It's got to be easy. You know, we're lazy people now. Can't be too difficult. Plus, people aren't too bright anymore. Can't be technically challenging for simpletons. And you got to admit, the general public, at least back in my day, you know, there were no degrees in computer science. If you had a quote-unquote computer science degree, you were an electrical engineer. Then there were those of us who weren't electrical engineers, but who grew up right in that age and had electrical engineers for boyfriends, like me, and had lots of friends who were into programming. I started learning programming myself. And so we just kind of grew up with it and tinkered with it and got to learn things before there were any books on it. Part of the Wild West. Learned how to hack things and slice and dice and make it work. Put them together from scratch from old components. Swip and swap them out. Soup it up and overclock things. I mean, it's pretty cool. But back from those days to today, you know, most people don't have any clue what's on the inside of a computer or even what the internet is or how it connects. I just saw some Google search survey that was showing like each state's top search survey. One of the states I saw was, what's inside the internet? Which made me kind of laugh, like it's a place or something. But anyway, all right, in the not-too-distant future, your bank will be able to prevent fraud by learning how you type. Your car will unlock when it senses the electrical activity from your heart. And the security system at your office will recognize your facial features. That is according to experts in the field of biometrics, which identifies a person by measuring unique characteristics such as fingerprints, their retinas, or their voice. But these types of distinctive identification processes offer more than promises of a higher degree of security than traditional passwords. Biometrics will also free consumers, yes, us consumers, who can't remember a thing anymore, they have to be told what to do, from the need to memorize a myriad of characters, which is really difficult, a convenience that will appeal to anyone who needs to access a secure computer or network regularly. People are having to jump through more and more hoops to create a secure authentication. Because of that, we need something simpler. How many times a day do you have to prove who you are, whether it be through a password, biometric, or other means? Banks and the financial service industry, more broadly, have been one of the quickest adopters of biometric technology, given their strong need for security and identity verification. Financial institutions are subject to stringent regulations on things like Know Your Client and anti-money laundering. And Royal Bank is currently testing out technologies such as iris scanning, facial recognition, speech recognition, and fingerprint scans, and it is expected to roll out these features to customers in 2017. They have had many successful pilot projects, with one with a wristband used to verify purchases, while MasterCard recently launched a service that allows users to verify their identities with their smartphones by taking a selfie or using a fingerprint scanner. Notably, it's the popularity of the fingerprint scanner on the Apple iPhone that's made consumers more comfortable and familiar with biometrics. Yes, leave it to Apple. Fortunately, Apple and some of the other digital players that have introduced biometric capabilities are in some way helping to train the consumers for us. Ding, ding. And here we go, and this is where it starts to get scary. Biometrics can also identify users based on how they behave. Remember, behavioral monitoring is something that is going on via surveillance. And they have algorithms running against that stuff to be able to tell whether or not you're acting suspicious, whether or not you're telling the truth. And it might not in the future, in the very near future, be something that is even being done by just law enforcement. Imagine going to a counter and, I don't know, requesting some airline tickets or something, and they ask you a few questions to verify your identity. And while they're verifying your identity, you're being scanned. Your heart rate's being monitored. And I don't know, I'm sure that they can do all that stuff via laser now. 230-point facial recognition, and then add to that a few algorithms, like we've been saying with the pre-crime and being able to determine your ethnicity, and then put that against a database to see whether or not you're likely to commit a crime in the future based upon different statistics that they've pulled together out of databases. That should be pretty frightening for you, especially if your face is going to be what you are judged by electronically. Biometrics can also identify users based on how they behave. For instance, their typing patterns. We've talked about this, and the way they swipe across the screen on a mobile device. The way that you actually interact with your phone and the way that you swipe the phone is fairly unique to you. And in the future, behavioral biometrics could even be used to detect if a fraudster has somehow gained access to your bank account and even your computer account. By the way you're typing, I had read a whole expose on using behavioral biometrics. That was something that Windows had talked about as part of Windows 10. I saw that they're using multiple different biometric logins, whether it be fingerprint, iris, or voice pattern, depending on what your computer can support. But I could guarantee you in an update somewhere, they're going to go to that behavioral thing, because that was something that was in their literature. We are now looking at how identity can be used to create completely personalized experiences, just like personalized medicine and mad science gone mad, pointing to cars as an example. So don't forget, too, we're going to have the self-driving car that is also going to be an artificially intelligent organism that we're going to put our trust into, that will be connected to this machine, that'll be able to scan you and identify you, record everything you say while you're in it, watch your behaviors while you're in it, and take you places autonomously. You may have shared a vehicle, but you have preferences in terms of the seat height and the position and the steering wheel and the entertainment and all those things. Cars will be able to personalize themselves. Yeah, that's the way. It's all about convenience. Experts concede that for some users, the technologies may evoke scenes from the popular science fiction film Minority Report, yes, which features a future of nearly boundless technological advances designed to protect its citizenry, just like today. There will be consumers who get creeped out. But don't worry about it. Ultimately, though, the technology gives that dopamine-seeking consumer a greater guarantee that their private information will be kept safe. Which, I don't know how that's possible. I don't think it's going to be kept safe. You're still always going to have hackers, and it's going to be floating around out there. It's going to be in the hands of the tech titans. How is it possibly going to be safe? We have an opportunity now, though, of course, to craft this in such a way that the privacy of the consumer is at the very heart of all of this. Well, yeah, the privacy of the consumer is not what the end game is all about. It is about being able to crack all of the mysteries of biology and make us a part of the machine. But in order to get us to be a part of the machine, they got to get us to embrace the machine and interacting on a daily basis with the machine is how they're going to do it. And they even said that earlier in the story about how they thank Apple for training the consumer to be used to utilizing biometrics. And that's what they have to do. They have to train us. See, this is a very slow process. Get us to believe in technology and science as the ultimate authority. Called scientism. Not to argue with it and to just go along with what they tell us and don't ask any questions. To eventually embrace it because we feel comfortable. It's all about our safety. Now, we've been reading too, a lot of this brain research that's been going on, of course, is to cure all kinds of diseases such as Parkinson's and Alzheimer's. And as they crack these mysteries, they'll be able to manipulate the brain in ways that we've never before seen and were never before possible. They can put little brain implants in. We've seen that. National Geographic TV broadcast it live. We've read about DARPA being able to flash flashes of light to get rid of unpleasant memories for PTSD patients who have had horrible experiences in their lives, and now they can make those bad memories go away. Well, they're one step further at reprogramming brains. Researchers reprogram a network of brain cells in mice with a thin beam of light. And this is the next generation of some of that research that we've looked at before. Neurons that fire together really do wire together, says a new study in Science, suggesting that a 3-pound computer in our heads may be more malleable than we think. In the latest issue of Science, neuroscientists at Columbia University demonstrate that a set of neurons trained to fire in unison could be reactivated as much as a day later if just one neuron in the network was stimulated. Though further research is needed, their findings suggest that groups of activated neurons may form the basic building blocks of learning and memory, as originally hypothesized by psychologist Donald Hebb in 1940. The researchers were able to control and observe the brain of a living mouse using the optogenetic tools. And we've talked about those before. Those are those flashes of light after they've genetically engineered the brain cells to be sensitive to light. Using the optogenetic tools that have revolutionized neuroscience in the last decade, they injected the mouse with a virus containing light-sensitive proteins engineered to reach specific brain cells. And once inside the cells, and remember, we've talked about that, that's how they do GMO. They take a virus, they suck the guts out, they put something else inside, like a Trojan horse payload, and they send it in to go infect cells and then modify that cell. And that's exactly what they've done. They inject the mouse with a virus containing light-sensitive proteins engineered to reach specific brain cells. And once inside a cell, the proteins allow researchers to remotely activate the neuron with light as if switching on a TV. The mouse was allowed to run freely on a treadmill while its head was still held under a microscope. With one laser, the researchers beamed light through its skull to stimulate a small group of cells in the visual cortex. They made him see things. And with the second laser, they recorded rising levels of calcium in each neuron as it fired, thus imaging the activity of individual cells. Before optogenetics, the scientists had to open the skull and implant electrodes into living tissue. Well, thank goodness they're not doing that anymore to stimulate neurons with electricity and measure their response. And even a mouse brain of 100 million neurons, nearly a thousandth the size of ours, was too dense to get a close look at groups of neurons. Optogenetics has allowed researchers to get inside the brain non-invasively and control it far more precisely. Did you hear that? We're going to read that again. Optogenetics has allowed researchers to get inside the brain non-invasively and control it far more precisely. And how did they get inside the brain? Well, they infected it with a virus that had genetically engineered proteins in it that allowed the cells to react to light. And then they shot laser beams at the head. And they were able to turn on certain neurons. I mean, think about this. Think about how insane this is. And what would prevent them from doing this en masse? I mean, I don't know. Can this be done outside the lab? This is really crazy. Optogenetics has allowed researchers to get inside the brain non-invasively and control it far more precisely. And in the last decade, researchers have restored sight and hearing to blind and deaf mice, turned normal mice aggressive, and all by manipulating specific regions of the brain. The breakthrough that allowed researchers to reprogram a cluster of cells in the brain is the culmination of more than a decade of work. Guys, they're reprogramming the brain. You know, after mousies, maybe come monkeys, then come people. And with the tissue samples from the mouse visual cortex, Yust and his colleagues showed in a 2003 study that in Nature that neurons coordinating their firing in small networks called neural assembles. And a year later, that demonstrated the assembles fired in sequential patterns through time. And as techniques for controlling and observing cells and living animals improved, they learned that these neural assembles are active even without stimulation. But the researchers think that the network of activated neurons they artificially created may have been implanting an image completely unfamiliar to the mouse. And they are now developing a behavioral study to try to prove this. We think that these methods to read and write into the living brain will have a major impact in neuroscience and medicine. Ding, ding, ding. Read and write activity into the living brain. How long is it going to be before its 21st century verily cures? That are going to fix your defective human brain that was diagnosed via smart applications and your voice patterns. Dr. Daniel Javitt, a psychiatry professor at Columbia University Medical Center, who was not involved in the study, says that we could potentially use this to restore normal connection patterns in the brain of people with epilepsy and other brain disorders, of course. But major technical hurdles would need to be overcome before optogenetic techniques could be applied to humans. Yes, yes, yes. But this research is part of a $300 million brain mapping effort called, ding, 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 the U.S. Brain Initiative. How many times have we talked about that? That is backed by executive actions or whatever they call them at the White House. They put all kinds of money behind it and wrote up a whole write-up and put it on whitehouse.gov. We are a part of the U.S. brain research, and every single one of us will eventually become a part of this machine. And this grew out of an earlier proposal by Yust and his colleagues for developing tools to map brain activity of fruit flies to more complex mammals, including humans. And that came out of Columbia University, another pit of lizards. All right, scientists discover brain circuits attached to moods and how to hack them. This is from July 2016. Imagine, just imagine being happy all the time. A devastating divorce, no problem. The boss dumping work on you without compensation, no big deal. Your kid throat punches someone at recess and might get expelled. Well, you can handle any of these situations calmly and walk away stress-free. Why? Because you've got a conscious handle on your emotions. You can turn your mood up or down at the twist of a dial, but how is that possible? Well, researchers at Duke University, experimenting again on little mousies, were recently able to identify the brain circuitry related to mood, and they used superfine electrodes along with minuscule amounts of a specific drug. Now, only were they able to classify which neurons are responsible for mood, but they were able to actually control the subject's mood by dialing it up and down at will. Ding, ding. This is another bit of DARPA research, just like the optogenetics. In a study in the July 20th issue of the journal Neuron, researchers were able to take mice prone to depression, anxiety, or stress and restore them to relative emotional health just by tweaking the circuitry responsible in their brains. Kafui Dirasa, which was the lead researcher in the study, he is an assistant professor of psychiatry, behavioral sciences, and neurobiology. And Dr. Ziraza said that if you quote-unquote turn up the volume on mice who hadn't had any stress, they soon become stressed. Those who had experienced stress and didn't manage it well had their emotional volumes turned back down. They went back to normal. These circuits or bundles of neurons regulate our emotional life, and this is what researchers call the emotional pacemaker of the brain, located where? Oh, in the prefrontal cortex. Duke researchers used several approaches to look at what role these circuits had in different mood disorders and brain stimulation. Brain stimulation, oh my God. In the prefrontal cortex could help lessen or alleviate things like anxiety, depression, bipolar disorder, and chronic stress, to name a few. And these disorders are at an epidemic proportion today. Of course they are. But lots of times, the drugs associated with them don't work or have really nasty side effects. So not only did Duke researchers want to understand how this complex system worked, but they wanted to know if it had implications for possible drug development. In the experiment, 32 electrode arrays were placed inside four precise areas of the little mice. And then the mice were subjected to stressful situations. And researchers recorded the activity they found within the brains. The kind of situation the mice encountered is known as chronic social defeat. You're no good, Johnny. And this allowed researchers to observe interaction between the limbic system and the prefrontal cortex, which is where it is believed major depression arises from. Still, the implications are enormous. The deep brain stimulation. Think about the societal costs which could be saved. All those with mental health issues. Yes, all those people out there, those defective humans. Many more to be diagnosed in the future. Could turn up or down their mood to overcome their disorder. Yes, let's just give someone access to our brain chemistry. And they can push buttons like a remote control on a TV. Isn't that what the last story said? Zippity zap zap. And change that mood. This discovery also contains the seeds of emotional totalitarianism. In decades or more to come, workers and activists could be made happy when they're really fed up. And thus, much needed societal change could be eliminated. Yeah. All right, all you discontents out there. Zip, zip, zip. You want to get your universal basic income? All you need to do is to get on that little surveillance chip. And any time you start to get chemically, mentally out of whack, we'll just be able to twist those little dials and tune you back into happy mode. We have emotions for a reason. And sure, sometimes one gets stuck in depression and anxiety and cannot function properly. But for others at times, our emotions are telling us that something is wrong with a relationship or in our career path, for instance. And an oyster only makes a pearl out of an irritant. Negative emotions force us to change and grow, and without them, opportunities for growth may be missed. Yeah, and just like everybody's got to win an award of some kind, even if you didn't do well. That's why, you know, you got to lose sometimes, because it kicks you back into shape, makes you work harder. Without them, opportunities may be missed, and we do not know the larger implications of complete conscious emotional control. Is there a mere technological fix? Sure. Just because you've changed someone's perception does not mean that the underlying problem has been solved, and this breakthrough has a lot of promise in terms of managing certain mental health issues, but unregulated. And if the same is true in human brains, this could lead to an anesthetized world where everyone is okay with everything and anything and nothing ever changes. And a brave new world where every negative emotion is diagnosable and soma is a ubiquitous pill prescribed by a doctor. And that is about where we're at right now. Can you say Paxil? I mean, once they could take us in for a treatment and give us a few brain zaps to be able to make us happy forever and not feel any discontent, you know that's going to happen at some point in the future. How will you ever have dissent? So now let's take a look. We talked about AI the other day and just how things are moving so quickly toward having artificially intelligent machines. Well, check this out. An AI watched 600 hours of TV and started to accurately predict what happens next. Now, again, this is this future prediction pre-crime behavioral monitoring type stuff that's very frightening. MIT researchers have created an algorithm that hopes to understand human visual social cues and predict what will happen next. Giving AI the ability to understand and predict human social interaction could one day pave the way to efficient home assistance systems, as well as intelligent security cameras that can call an ambulance or the police ahead of time. Now, you know, let's hack the brain so we can manipulate it and change it and read things from it and put things in it. And now let's create artificial intelligences with algorithms that can do precognition and be able to determine whether or not you're a threat, whether or not you're going to do something that it doesn't agree with before you've ever done it. MIT, again, Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Laboratory, created an algorithm that uses deep learning, which is artificial intelligence, to use patterns of human interaction to predict what will happen next. Researchers fed the program with videos featuring human social interactions and tested it to see if it learned well enough to be able to predict them. The researchers' weapon of choice, well, 600 hours of YouTube videos and sitcoms, including The Office, Desperate Housewives, and Scrubs. And while this lineup may seem questionable, MIT's doctoral candidate and project researcher Carl Vondrick reasons out that accessibility and realism were part of the criteria. We just wanted to use random videos from YouTube, he says, and the reason for television is that it's easy for us to get access to that data, and it's somewhat realistic in terms of describing everyday situations. They showed the computers videos of people who are 1 second away from doing one of these four actions, hugging, kissing, high-fiving, and handshaking, and AI was able to guess correctly 43% of the time compared to humans, who were right 71% of the time. So that's it. They're still not quite there yet. But giving AI the ability to understand visuals the way humans can could be a precursor to what would be efficient home assistance, as well as intelligent security cameras that call an ambulance or police ahead of time. This new algorithm deviates from previous attempts at video predicting, wherein pixel-by-pixel representations were a priority. It predicts using abstract representations and focuses on important signs, and it learns on its own and uses visual representations to discriminate between visual cues that are important in social interactions from those that are not. It's something that actually comes naturally to humans, but is far more complicated in AI. And, you know, as we give computers more senses, like this will be the visual processing unit, so they can actually see things and then process what they are seeing in images, you know, they're going to become more and more aware of their environment. Once we allow them to hear, which we already do with voice processing and being able to listen to your voice and determine what you're saying. They have the Microsoft algorithm that does all of the on-the-fly translation through Skype already. And that allows them to determine what is being said and process that information and apply it toward another language in a database. You know, it's not going to be too long. They were saying already that they're looking at putting emotions and allowing machines to feel pain. What's left? Taste? Smell? They already have smell. That's where they're doing sensors, biosensors, and external sensors to be able to determine whether or not there's a certain chemical substance in the air. I mean, that's all it boils down to. What else are these going to need to be able to be better than us, to be able to be utilized instead of a human, to see things, to think? I mean, we already read about the M's, the brain emulations. Are we able to copy a brain and make it 1,000 times faster than ours already is? And don't think that then that isn't going to be able to be uploaded somewhere and copied. They already said that. Where we ended the show yesterday, scientists predict that brain simulations, and this is these M's, will take over our jobs and the government in the next 100 years. Economist Robin Anson's new book, The Age of M, Work, Love, Life, When Robots Rule the Earth, imagines a not-too-distant future when robots are commonplace in our life, and the smartest of these will be M's, or brain emulations. They will be super detailed scans of actual human brains that run as models on computers, and once we figure out how to pull that off cheaply, M's will take over most human jobs. The advantage of M's will have that they will be running 1,000 times faster than the actual human brain, and you'll also be able to copy them. Wouldn't you rather scan and duplicate the brain of Stephen Hawking and have that M do almost everything? And the moment when M's will take over is similar to the singularity famously proposed by futurist Ray Kurzweil. But Hansen thinks the brain M will come in the next 100 years sooner than self-aware AI, because they will be recreations of brains rather than harder to create brain consciousnesses. Brain M's can come as a culmination of technology we already employ, like brain scans and models, and one day we'll be able to know just everything there is to know about brains, and we'll be able to get computers to mimic them. How will we create M's? Well, the book explains, quote, an M results from taking a particular human brain, scanning it to record its particular cell features and connections, and then building a computer model that processes signals according to these same features and connections. And a good enough M has close to the same overall input-output signal behavior as the original human. One might talk with it and convince it to do useful jobs. And once that happens, M's will basically beat humans at being more cost-effective at all jobs. Emulations will perform most of their tasks in virtual reality, and for physical jobs like factory work, they will have some specialized bodies, quote-unquote. Like uploading and downloading Nana at Christmas time into her avatar. M's will be functioning creatures that will develop and live in the same world as humans, but will eventually develop their own civilization. And once M's will be doing most of our jobs, humans will have to create a new civilization for themselves. What? Hansen imagines M's will be congregating in a few megacities full of technology, while the humans will live essentially retired in the suburbs, and the M's will be running all the businesses and the government. The rest of the people will generally not work. Ding, ding. And you know what, guys? This is in that mainstream publication, Big Think. They're laying out some ideas here that we've postulated, and this is pretty frightening. The rest of the people will generally not work. They'll get their universal basic income and just sit around and be pretty, especially if they manage to make good investments or have government or corporate insurance. Some will financially benefit from being the originals whose brain scans were used to create M's. You think so? I don't think so. I think they're going to rebel. And interestingly, the descendants of the original human, or copies, will together be called a clan. And there will, of course, be many left behind. If there are rich humans who just get a thrill out of hiring real human waiters, or even real human prostitutes, perhaps, and those jobs might be done by humans. But still, Hansen does not see the future as gloomy. An age of M's will come, but will eventually be replaced by something even stranger. From the human perspective, the age of M's will be an end result of the current general positive trajectory, which I don't see things as a positive trajectory right now, so I am in protest against this story. People have seen consistent trends not only to individual wealth, but also toward more democracy, less slavery, more leisure, more promiscuity, less religion. In other words, the world is getting better. You think so? There have also been people telling you that the world is getting worse, and objectively, that is less true today. Hansen does not see a Terminator-like scenario with Skynet attempting to exterminate humanity. He sees M's to behave more like giant corporations that will grow within legal means. Well, that's not even a good scenario. Robin Anson is an AI veteran with 9 years of AI research under his belt at Lockheed Martin and NASA, and he currently teaches at George Mason University and researches at Oxford University. So there you go. The land of M's. Sounds like we're not going to have much of a place, but can we trust robots? And that is the question. Are you going to get into a self-driving car and allow the algorithms to make decisions? Are you going to get under the knife with a robot surgeon and allow them to cut you open and put new parts in? Robots will soon have the power of life and death over human beings, but are they ready? And are we? This is out of IEEE Spectrum. In popular culture, robots tend to be either faultlessly loyal Victorian butlers or duplicitous psychopathic killers, and consider C-3PO in Star Wars and Ava in Ex Machina or Robbie in Forbidden Planet and Hal in 2001 A Space Odyssey. Those depictions are, of course, just reflections of our own hopes and fears, but those fears, at least, have started leaking out into the real world, and in recent years, dozens of tech and science luminaries have shared their apprehension of AI run amok, of superintelligent robots establishing a new world in which humans are at best irrelevant and at worst extinct. Their fearful scenarios aren't much different than the ones that sci-fi writers conjured decades ago, but their concerns have resonated widely because of the lofty status of some of those folks, who include Stephen Hawking, Bill Gates, Bill Joy, and Elon Musk. And it's not so much pedantic piffle. We and our machines are on the cusp of a new relationship. And in the not-so-distant future, we will begin entrusting robotic systems that are highly or completely autonomous to such vital tasks as driving a car, performing surgery, and choosing when to apply lethal force in a war zone. And for the first time, machines programmed, but not directly controlled by us, will be making life and death decisions in complicated, fluid, and unstructured environments. Now, we've said that. We've been talking about this for a long time, and the ethics of having autonomy, making a decision as to whether or not to kill, or whether or not to convict. I mean, we were reading about that pre-crime yesterday, utilizing algorithms, and they said that in the future, our whole judicial system will have to be rewritten. So are they going to punish you for a crime that you haven't committed yet and put you into a prison? And they will have AI making that decision based upon what they determine you might have done in the future wrong, utilizing things such as predictive technologies and artificial intelligence. It's a very, very frightening dystopia. Undoubtedly, of course, as they learn more and more about the brain, that isn't going to be difficult. Like I said, our last bastion of freedom is to be able to have a thought and try to have some sort of discussion with ourselves inside of our head to determine ethics, what's right or wrong, whether or not we have free will to make a decision, and we will no longer have free will. Undoubtedly, mistakes will be made and people will die. But don't worry about it, because it'll be in smaller numbers than they do now. Getting from here to there won't be straightforward, and as we describe in this report, the challenges will span technical, regulatory, and even philosophical realms. And besides the coding and policy problems, the new autonomous systems will force us to confront deep moral quandaries. They might even tweak the sense of who we are. But in the end, the world will probably be a better place. Now, do you really think that? I don't think so. And talking about artificial intelligence, I found this just before I started the show today. It's the first time I've seen this. We've talked about self-driving cars, and now they have the self-driving semis that they're rolling out across Europe. They just did a couple big tests with convoys, carting across from one side to the other for large convoys of these autonomous tractor trailers. Well, they're not going to be the only things. Yamaha may fit its motorcycles with safety-focused artificial intelligence. Artificial intelligence on a motorcycle. Yamaha Motors will work on developing new safety technology to reduce motorcycle spills, says President Hiroyuki Yanagi in a recent interview. He said that the systems may draw on artificial intelligence jointly developed with U.S. research body that allows humanoid robots to ride motorcycles. I've seen that in a Russian film from RT, but I have not seen that in the U.S. We want to facilitate driving operations of our motorcycles and reduce the burden on riders to allow them to pay more attention to safety. Yamaha hopes to reverse the slumping domestic sales by adopting advanced technologies to reduce motorcycle accidents such as overturns and collisions. And we will use the expertise we've acquired from robots for our motorcycles. We will promote the development of technologies to make motorcycle driving easier. And although Yamaha has not decided when to put the AI-based technologies into use, the company will consider adopting them in future models. Its top-end 1,000 cubic centimeter YZF-R1 motorcycle released overseas last year has advanced technology that regulates its engine, brakes, and suspension. And we've actually looked at those, a friend and I. All right, and last but not least, I don't know, is this the end here? Do we have, oh, we have two. Talking about robotics and AI and surgery, robotic doctors, this is horrifying. This really had to make me squirm. This is good for a Friday. The future of robotic surgery, snake like bots that glide into orifices. Now, how horrifying is that? Oh, letting a snake-like robot glide into your mouth and down your throat may sound a bit alarming. Oh, yes, it does. Horrifying, as a matter of fact. But letting such a robot glide into any other of your orifices may sound even more alarming still. Oh my god. But the Flex robotic system from Medrobotics in Raynham, Mass, or Massachusetts, has earned high praise from a head and neck surgeon who has sent it snaking down 19 of his patients' throats as of today. And it is really changing the way I do business, says David Goldberg, director of Olin Terrell Gloglies Surgery at Penn State. Oh, not again. Hershey Medical Center. It is the future of head and neck surgery, and his surgical colleagues in the colorectal and OBGYN departments, oh my God, are also planning clinical trials using Flex, Goldberg told IEEE Spectrum. The Flex entered the U.S. market just last year, in the European market the year before, and getting it approved by regulators was no easy task. Wonder how they beta tested that sucker. Interestingly, the biggest hassle was ensuring that the robot was dumb enough to meet the U.S. Food and Drug Administration's requirements. What? We approached the FDA. Almost the first question out of their mouth was about the autonomous nature of the robot. They raised it as a serious red flag, says Medro Robotics CEO Samuel Straface. We had to show that the surgeon had complete and absolute control at all times. If it was any other way, we would still be in a science project. The new robots coming out are giving surgeons the new capability, but really, they are still just the tools in the hands of the all-powerful human. And that is because the FDA has barred anything resembling an autonomous robotic assistant from the operating room. Probably a good thing, I would say. Roboticists may see autonomous surgical robots as a grand research goal, as Spectrum explored recently in the feature article, Would You Trust a Robot Surgeon to Operate on You? And you know, I had that queued up. We never covered that one. Maybe we will on Monday. And recent triumphs, like an autonomous system that stitched up pigs' intestines more effectively than surgeons, have demonstrated their progress. But it is a long way from the lab to the clinic, as Medrobotics discovered. We are injecting some reality. Just because you can build these things doesn't mean you can sell them. And the Flex, as its name implies, is a flexible tube-like thing. The surgeon glides it into the patient's mouth and steers it with a joystick. A camera at the flex tip lets the surgeon see and navigate the twists and turns of the patient's airway. And since it can reach otherwise inaccessible spots, surgeons like Goldberg are using it for operations that would otherwise require them to crack a patient's jaw or make an incision. Goldberg says that it makes many procedures cheaper, faster, easier, and less dramatic to his patients. And once the flex reaches the surgical target, it stiffens and provides a stable platform for instruments. To move the flex, the surgeon presses a switch on a controller, but Stratface explains that the system also includes a foot pedal that controls the power to the overall system, turning the motor on and off. Only one autonomous feature was permitted on the flex. Once the bot's work was done, it can steer itself back up and out of the patient's body. That independent movement is considered acceptable because it is just reversing the path that the human surgeon plotted on the way in. He hastened to say that everyone at Medrobotics is very glad that regulators obsess about patient safety. Of course they did. Sticking hard robots into people's soft bodies is inherently dangerous, and no one wants a bot going rogue inside of an airway or a digestive tract. No, we don't. And that safety imperative may point to ways that particular kinds of R&D are being done on robotic autonomy. If a smarter surgical tool can make a procedure less risky, the FDA may give it approval. For example, an inserted tool could have more sensing capabilities and could give the surgeon more feedback. For example, sounding an alarm or stopping short if it's about to collide with tissue. It won't be autonomy for the sake of taking the surgeon out of the picture. That will not fly. Goldberg hopes there will never be a fully automated surgical robot. Well, no, of course he doesn't, because then he won't have his BMW and his big McMansion. Not because I'm afraid of being replaced. No, robots aren't going to take off our jobs. But because surgery is an art form that requires judgment and decision-making. The Medrobotics team isn't trying to build an artificially intelligent surgical robot that understands moral reasoning. But if you went back to the 60s and polled all the roboticists, they universally thought that we'd have humanoid robots doing housework by now. Instead, we got dishwashers and the Roomba. All right, guys, well, make sure you stick around because it is Friday. All kinds of great radio tonight and all kinds of stuff this weekend. All right, guys, have an awesome Friday, and I will catch up with you on Monday.
The anti